Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the program is Fight the Empire. And our guest is Alfred McCoy, who's a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin. He's the author of the several books, The Politics of Heroin, which is sort of a definitive book on the CIA and the drug trade. More recently, Policing America's Empire. And today we're going to focus on this article that appeared in the Tom Dispatch, which is a really wonderful website, a lot of good stuff in the Tom Dispatch. And it's called Taking Down America. And Professor McCoy, you're there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Per.
Now, in this, it's mentioned that you're the convener of the Empires in Transition Project. Why don't you tell us a bit about that, and then we'll get into the article.
Sure. 6 years ago, we decided it was time to take a look at the character of the United States as a global power, its rise and decline. And so we pulled together a loose network of 140 historians on four continents, and we convened a succession of international seminars and meetings. The first was Madison in 2006, then Sydney, Australia, then Manila, Philippines. And just this June, we met in Barcelona, Spain. And the topic of our last meeting in Barcelona was comparative imperial decline. And we gathered some leading historians from across Europe, specialists in the history of their respective national empires, Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands. And they looked at the nature of their imperial decline, and we extracted from that some lessons, some patterns, and then we applied it to the current context of U.S. global power and projected into the future. And we then, based upon a book we're working on called Endless Empire, we drew those papers together. I drafted an introduction from that, and then for the Tom Dispatch website, I wrote a kind of popular version with all the, if you will, all the historiographic work and all the nuanced analysis, kind of, if you will, reduced to fairly clear, coherent statements, and put it out in that article that you mentioned on Tom Dispatch.
And so this book will be published next year, Endless Empire.
Right, that's correct.
Europe's Eclipse, America's Ascent, and the Decline of U.S. Global Power. So, and you have one empire kind of going down, another one rising, and then that one declining. So, in your article, you say that basically the American century is got about maybe 15 years to go.
Right. Well, what we said is that, first of all, empires are far more fragile than one might expect. They're a delicate ecology. A careful balance of military, economic power, cultural authority, and diplomatic agility, diplomatic influence. And when they start to wind down in one or more of these areas, there is a kind of, if you will, a synergistic reaction, and the decline is far faster than anybody could have imagined at the peak of imperial power. To take an example, in 1897, the British studied the celebrated the Victoria's Jubilee with all kinds of hyperbolic rhetoric about the endless British domain, and then just 17 years later, they were destroying themselves in the trenches of the of World War I, slaughtering what became 10 million. Members of Europe's empires, marking the beginning of a decline. So imperial decline, once it starts, happens very quickly. Portugal lost its empire in a year. Great Britain lost its global empire in just 17 years. So we figure that, looking backward, and again, this is an inference. We're talking about the future, and nobody knows really what's going to happen, but just guessing. The historians looking back will see the beginning of America's decline with the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And then if you track current trajectories forward from various U.S. government reports, you get to what looks like a fatal clustering of negative factors for U.S. global power that should come together around 2025. So the American decline looks like it'll be about 22 years from 2003 to 2025. And we've got just about 15 years to go.
Mm.
And 15 years, the clock is ticking towards midnight on the American century.
And you think there's any planning involved? I mean, are they thinking ahead? Are leaders thinking ahead this far, or are they just kind of flailing?
Oh, no, no. Actually, it's very interesting. The U.S. National Intelligence Council, which is, if you will, a kind of an interagency committee drawn from the 16 organizations that make up the U.S. intelligence community, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and National and all the rest, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research and the U.S. State Department, one could go on. There's 16 of them, and they have this National Intelligence Council. And periodically, they issue futurology reports. And their latest one is projecting forward to 2025. And for the first time, the U.S. National Intelligence Council states, you know, bluntly, directly, that an historic shift of global economic power, unprecedented in human history, from west, that's to say Europe and the United States, to east, that's to say China and Japan, will mean that U.S. global power will decline even in the military realm. So the U.S. National Intelligence Council is projecting a significant, measurable decline in U.S. global power by 2025. Now, my own rather darker projections of the U.S. government coincide around that date. Now, what I argue from the study of the past is, in fact, that this will not be the kind of soft landing that everybody in Washington seems to imagine, that somehow we're operating in a kind of benign international environment, and as our power fades, that our allies are going to sort of let us down gently, if you will, kind of letting a wounded warrior fall slowly to the ground and cosseting and cuddling them in their arms. No, this is we take a much more realpolitik approach. When empires start to fall apart, when they start to wind down, there's a synergy of factors that mean that decline comes very quickly. And the consequences for the declining power are often very unfortunate. The quality of life for a generation or more in the formal imperial power is really diminished, and political conflicts often rise. So it's not a benign process.
Tell us about the details of how it would affect just the ordinary person. I mean, the British Empire, they declined kind of gradually. Of course, the U.S. was there to kind of pick it up, but we don't have a friendly ally to pick it up for us.
All right, that's a very good point. If you look at comparative imperial declines, you'd have to say that the British had the optimum situation. Why? Because even at the peak of their power, many people in the British government were aware that Britain was a small island running a very large, dynamic world, and they had a sense of the fragility of British power, unlike the United States. So that as their power began to wane after World War One, and particularly after World War II, when that decline really accelerated from 1947 with the independence for India, the loss of India, right to the mid-1960s when most of the major African colonies became independent. In that 17-year period, for the most part, the British accepted that they were in a period of decline, and they managed it. And they managed it so that they adjusted economically, so that although there was rationing in Britain, you know, for a decade after World War II, very unpleasant time, nonetheless, it was managed and controlled. That they also managed their military withdrawal, turning over bases to either independent nations or, in many cases, to the United States. And they preserved, if you think about it, what was one of the cores of the British Empire. They preserved the global economic role of the City of London as a major center for global capitalism. Moreover, they also preserved the cultural influence of the English language and turned that into a very dynamic export industry. Also a very dynamic tourism industry.
And the Beatles, too.
Moreover, they left their imprint on the global system so that the best of, if you will, the British legacy was preserved. So by careful planning and management, the British optimized their post-imperial position quite successfully. So we're not doing the same.
No, that's the question. Are we going to fight it or go along with it and try and make it easier?
I think that the partisan politics in the United States and also the nature of American identity and ideology is really militating, blocking, such a rational transition.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at recently, for example, Mike Huckabee and Sarah Palin on the right of the Republican Party have been attacking President Obama because he does not fully embrace the idea of American exceptionalism, which in their view is almost a divine, America has a divinely ordained right to global power. And if you, for Obama, America is a global power, and America's decline, and Obama talks about it all the time. He talked about it in his first two State of the Union addresses to the U.S. Congress and the American people. Joe Biden, our vice president, has been talking about this a lot. Okay, for them, they're rationalists and realists. This is a problem to be addressed, kind of in the British mode. For the right of the Republican Party, any discussion of possible U.S. decline is almost a sacrilege.
Mm.
To even engage the topic is tantamount almost to treason from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And this partisan division really blocks any kind of rational planning, just as partisan divisions are really blocking any kind of rational economic adjustment to a changing global world.
So it's like the U.S. Under them would, instead of bending, it would break.
Exactly. I think that you can see that. You know, in that article, I addressed four scenarios.
Yeah, I was going to get to those. Why don't we talk the four scenarios are the economic decline, an oil shock, which I think is pretty much related, a military misadventure, and finally, World War III, which would be a cyber war with no casualties. And so which one do you want to start with?
Take them in order. Let's start with the fundamentals of mm-hmm. any empire's global power, the economic basis
mm-hmm.
of global power. Everybody agrees that's critical. And when we looked at, in a comparative imperial context, we identified among the many variables in economic performance, three essentials of global power in a modern economic order. The first, very importantly, is your kind of your gross throwaway, your presence on the stage, world stage, or in the world economy, measured most importantly by exports. Already the United States has fallen to the world's number three exporter. The European Union has about 16% of world commodity exports. China has 12%. And in the latest figures, we're down to 11%. We're declining. And we're declining markedly. We're going to fall to fourth, fifth, and even sixth place by 2025. So that's on a downward trajectory. The second, and almost equally, if not more important, is not just your gross throw weight in the world economy, but your capacity for innovation to come up with new products and processes that give you either, you know, gross exports or global economic leadership. The index that we found that measures current status best is worldwide patent registrations. For the last year, we have this information available, 2008. The United States was number one in worldwide patent registrations with about 240,000. China was number two with 190,000. But here's the kicker. From 2000 to 2008, the number of U.S. patents registered worldwide had increased 40%. The number of Chinese patents had increased 400%. Their
mm-hmm.
patents are growing at 10 times the rate of the United States. And if you extrapolate that forward, even modestly, you'll see that China, in just a few years, is going to pass the United States as the number one nation for the registration of worldwide patents on certifiably innovative techniques. Okay? And then you say, well, okay, so China in a couple of years is going to pass us, but what about 2025? And here we turn to the international testing of high school students that's done by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the Rich Nations Club. And they administer a very systematic, very rigorous test called the PISA test. And they've been doing it for about 10, 15 years now. The latest test results came out just about 10 days ago. And it showed that in, let's say, take math, that 5,000 students in Shanghai tested, they were off the charts. They scored 600 on that test and were number one. Where was the United States? We scored, 5,000 American students similarly tested, we scored 487. China, 600. We're at 487.
Mm-hmm.
They're number one. And where are we? Number 31.
Oh, my.
We can say, so what? That's just 15-year-old high school kids, right? What difference do they make? Right. I'll tell you what difference they make. In 15 years, in 2025, the date we're picking for the end of U.S. global power, those will be 30-year-old scientists and engineers. And as we all know, scientists and engineers often have the mind is agile in your 20s. They often have their real breakthroughs. They make their real contributions. So that means that looking forward in 2025, that as tested now, those Chinese scientists and engineers are going to be almost 20% smarter, faster, quicker than their American counterparts. Mm-hmm.
Well, the upshot of this scenario basically is that the U.S. dollar is no longer the almighty reserve currency, and so imports get more expensive, the military budget is slashed, and the U.S. forces kind of pull back. And then a far right-wing president demands respect, but he's just ignored. So this is kind of a quiet decline. But let's get into the oil shock.
All right. Well, actually, one thing about this is one thing most people don't realize is when we set up the Bretton Woods system in 1944-45, initially everybody would settle their trade deficits in gold, continuing the old British gold standard that had marked their empire. From the late 19th through the mid-20th century, okay? And in 1971, when we got the economic irrationalities and the massive deficit from the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration solved that problem by announcing unilaterally, that forget gold, we're going to now settle our deficit in U.S. dollars, okay? And that made the dollar the world's global reserve currency, and it's been such for the past 40 years. Well, now banks around the world are holding $4 trillion in U.S. dollars. The president of Russia, Medvedev, and the governor of China's central bank have announced beginning last year that we need to move beyond the dollar as global reserve currency. Well, if the dollar loses that status and we go to a basket, let's say Chinese yuan, Japanese yen, and European euros, that'll mean that we won't be able to export our deficit and get low-cost credit internationally. The banks won't buy another couple of $1 trillion in U.S. Treasury notes. So that'll mean, as you said, cost of credit will go up, capital inflow will slow, and our economy will wind down. And one of the ways that's going to impact upon it will be, of course, oil, because right now all oil transactions internationally are done through U.S. dollars, giving us an enormous advantage. Now, let's look at the projections of the U.S. Department of Energy. They do long-term projections on energy supplies, and what they're saying is that by 2025, the date which we're talking about, the decline of U.S. global power, the United States will, according to our government's projections, only get 12%, a puny 12% of our total energy needs will come from alternative energy sources. And by 2025, under current projections, we will still be accounting or gaining half, almost 50% of our total energy needs from imported oil. Now, what's wrong with that? I'll tell you what's wrong with that. Right now, what's happened is that China and India are entering the global economy with automobiles, high-speed trains, massive construction. In other words, no longer are these peasants, pushing carts or moving things by bullock as they've done for millennia. We got nearly half of humanity are becoming right now potent energy consumers. Indeed, for the first time in 100 years, just this summer, the United States was knocked off its number one position as leading oil consumer. China became the world's number one oil consumer. So even if oil supplies remain constant, which you can argue about, it's clear that demand from China and India is going to go up faster than supply. What does that mean? Prices will go up. Now, economists and economic planners around the globe can see this. And what they're doing in order to protect the integrity of their national industries and to protect their national energy grids, nations around the world are converting to alternative energy. Portugal already has 40% of its total energy right now coming from alternative energy. Denmark gets 27% of its energy from wind. Germany is developing solar passive houses that cut energy use for home heating by 90%. China already produces 50% of the world's wind turbines, 25% of the world's solar panels. And what's the U.S. plan for converting to alternative energy? Or what's the U.S. plan for 2025? Continue to import high-cost oil. This means we're enormously vulnerable to an oil shock, or we're very vulnerable to a long-term increase in the price of oil,
mm-hmm.
which means that our industries are going to become non-competitive. Our transport costs will become non-competitive. And so when people talk about siting a new manufacturing plant somewhere in the world, they will have to avoid the United States because our cost of production will be non-competitive on a global scale.
Well, then, you know, China and India and Russia, I mean, they are sort of, they constitute the world heartland, and they are closer to the sources of oil when they can transport it by pipeline, where we would have to go from pipeline to oil tankers, which are, you know, it's a longer distance.
Yeah, the other projection mm-hmm. that the U.S. National Intelligence Council made, and this is in their report, they calculate that by 2025, that there will be two energy kingpins on the globe, Russia and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is a cautious, if you will, not exactly ally, a cautious partner. Iran is, of course, one of our rogue states. And so basically what it is that our potential enemies are going to be the source of 60% of the world's oil and gas.
Do you think this is...
And that means that our you know, the remaining dependent upon mm-hmm. foreign supplies of oil and gas has very real consequences for the United States. The next scenario that we described in that article is the possibility of what we call micromilitarism.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found by a comparative study of the decline of European empires is that in almost every case, as imperial power winds down, it represents a severe psychological shock to the national community and to national identity, whether France, Britain, Spain, Portugal, or the Netherlands. Every imperial power finds the slow decline or the sudden loss of imperial power just an emotional psychological shock. And one of the ways quite consistently that imperial powers react, and they react irrationally to the pain of retreat or defeat, is they launch seemingly bold military strikes to try and recapture their fading substance through a kind of daring military operation. And these oftentimes turn into either disasters that hemorrhage money or just outright military debacles. The classic case, of course, is as Britain was managing quite rationally its staged decolonization, pulling back from Singapore through Suez to Europe, that at midpoint in this process, the emotional psychological strain became overwhelming, and they decided to recover their control over Suez by launching a military strike against Egypt and occupying Suez.
Mm-hmm.
That was a tremendous diplomatic disaster, which showed the world that the mighty British Navy, Britain's global power, was gone. It also meant that in the aftermath, the Britain had to give up the pound sterling's autonomy and agree to convertibility to the dollar, marking the end of the pound as a global currency.
But President Eisenhower put an end to that. I was in the Army at the time, and they were threatening us with going to fight in the Suez Canal rather than do our regular tour of duty in Germany. But why don't we quickly get on to the World War III cyber attack, and then, because we have to wrap up pretty soon.
Sure, right, very quickly. Just got a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the things that's happening, of course, is that as empires decline, you go down. Oftentimes, what you'll find is that the rising power will be a close ally. So, for example, as Britain power has faded, its global strategic partner, the United States, basically grab British power. When the British had that crisis in the Suez, we played upon it quite cynically to end British power and to advantage ourselves. And China, of course, is our number one foreign trading partner. It's very close to us economically, and it's playing upon that to amass capital to build a modernized military that can challenge the United States. And suddenly this summer, we've seen when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced that the U.S. had a national interest in the South China Sea, that ramped up a rhetoric of confrontation with China. The Pentagon issued a report that said that China is building a global missile force and capacity for warfare across the spectrum, including cyber warfare and space warfare. So what I did is I took the current weapons under development in the Pentagon, and I projected that, let's say, Thanksgiving Day in 2025, as American cyber shoppers are pounding at the portals of Best Buy, suddenly on the island of Maui, the U.S. Space Surveillance Telescope, which is part of a global system that will by then give us a, if you will, a visual panorama of the entire sky above the Earth to manage our space network of satellites and space drones. Suddenly, that telescope goes black. And then a next blow, a U.S. solar-powered 400-foot-wide Vulture aircraft flying an unmanned drone 400 feet wide, flying over the Yellow Sea. Suddenly, Chinese cyber warriors hack in, and the triple terminator missiles in pods beneath the giant wingspan of the Vulture drone suddenly fire, and they crash aimlessly into the waters below, disarming one of our most powerful weapons flying at 70,000 feet above the Earth. In the United States, the U.S. Cyber Warfare Center at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas determines the digital fingerprints of Chinese cyber warfare, and the President of the United States orders an immediate retaliatory strike. Flying at 250 feet above the Earth, the U.S. flotilla of X-37B space drones signals the launch of its triple terminator missile to knock out the 35 Chinese satellites flying in geostational orbit. There is no response. The Chinese have hacked our space drones.
Wow.
And then the Chinese cyber warfare virus spreads through the U.S. fractionated F-6 satellite system. No longer will we have single satellites, but the components will be floating around separately in space, linked by microwave communications. Suddenly, these all go dead. The U.S. forces in the Pacific, the carrier fleets, start seeming circles aimlessly mid-Pacific because they can't navigate. U.S. fighters worldwide are grounded because they can't fly. And U.S. drones, Predator and Reaper drones, fly aimlessly toward the horizon, crashing when they run out of gas.
Well, that's quite I think we're going to have to end it right there. That's a fascinating note right there. We've been talking with Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin. And I'd love to talk about this some more. This is a fascinating topic, and wish we had more time. But is there any way we can find out about this Empires in Transition project?
Sure. If you go to the Articles of Time Dispatch, mm-hmm. you'll find there a link to the homepage of the project. Mm-hmm. And it cites publications and mm-hmm. gives you links to the various conferences. If you want, you can read the papers at the conferences. And you can find our first conference volume, in which we analyze the nature of U.S. global power,
okay.
the origins of U.S. global power, a book called Colonial Crucible.
Well, thank
Empire
you.
The Making of the Modern American State.
Well, we will do that. Thank you very much for being with us. I wish
Thanks
we had more time.
Pleasure talking. Bye-bye.